It's July 14th, 2016. Happy Bastille Day. Happy Tape Measure Day. Happy Pandemonium Day. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, on Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things you can do to help support this podcast and all the work we do with Raging Chicken. Raging Chicken is a big announcement, folks. You know, Raging Chicken also turned five years old just two short weeks ago. Woo-hoo! But you can keep progressive activist media going strong by becoming a member for as little as $2 a month. Our 2016 membership drive is all about preparing for the next 5 years of pull no punches progressive media in PA. Simply go to RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, just click the green Become a Patron button right at the top of the page and you'll be on your way. And be sure to check out all the thank you gifts we have from each membership level while you're there. Well, I'll tell you, folks, we've been away for a couple weeks. Sean's been away from the mic. I've been away, like, out of Pennsylvania for a little bit, visiting my folks and stuff up in the Adirondacks. So, hey, Sean, welcome back, man.
Hey, how's it going? How was your trip?
It was fantastic. You know, it was great. You know, it was probably the best vacation I had in a while, in part because on my second day up there, I dove into the water with my phone in the pocket. So I destroyed my phone on day two. And it was actually good. It kind of got me really away from kind of following everything that was going on and spending lots of time with the kids. You know, my son got in a kayak for the first time and paddled all around the lakes. And so it was a really good time. And so, you know, you can't ask for more than that. But it was tough coming back, I'll tell you. And, you know, while I was up there, I think I mentioned this to you, like, a few days back when I was up there, ran into a couple great breweries that I want to talk about in our last segment today. Talked to the owners of one of the breweries up there. These two breweries, one called the Fulton Chain Brewery in Old Forge, New York. That's actually just about a year old. And I was up there last year for a brief visit. I missed their opening by literally a couple of days. So it was great to actually go there and sample all their beers. You can check. And then by surprise, literally a bike ride from my parents' house, there was this brewery that sprung up, I guess, in January when they opened, called Woodland Hop Farm and Fermentation. It's in Marcy, New York. And went there a few times, and their beer was freaking outstanding. So we'll come back to that in Happy's at the end. We can talk beer at the end. You can let me know what's happening here in PA on the beer front.
I will. I could share some tales of what it was like watching all that sunny side up fly out the door a couple Fridays ago.
Yeah, you definitely got it. I mean, you know, I watched some of the videos that you posted just of the canning process and stuff like that. I mean, that sounds like a custom. Yeah, we'll go through all that in the final segment today. But I'll tell you, before we get into everything that's happened, I just want to give folks an update on the Brewcast. If you remember last week, my plan was for last week to release our first ever episode of the Brewcast. The Brewcast is a collaboration with Binyak Biotech Brews. Matthew Binyak is a home brewer, and we're basically going to be following the home brewing process for the concept to the first taste. And he's brewing a Belgian strong ale. It's his own recipe. And so he's just kind of starting the process now. So we did our kind of first kind of intro episode, and I was hoping to be able to edit it all down. We got some original music for it too and stuff, which is, I was waiting for that. And then when we were trying to edit it down, I was on vacation. The sound quality was not coming up. So I apologize for those folks. If you were looking forward to that release of the first podcast, you know, it's going to be out there this week. So before I forget, I want to give you an update on that. But so Sean, I was away and without my phone and not following the news very closely, just kind of enjoying myself. And it was like, come back to Pennsylvania for like a shit show. I mean, it's like on the one hand, not just in Pennsylvania, but you know,
around the country.
I mean, you listen to the rundown of just like, you know, we've got the shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, the five police officers that were shot in Dallas, and the completely counterproductive responses from PA and New Jersey legislators, which we're going to get into. Still no contract for ABSCUF. Just yesterday, Ken Mash, president of ABSCUF, was out there at the Board of Governors meeting, or maybe today, it might have been this morning, a Board of Governors meeting, basically saying, look, we don't feel like we're in this together. Things are not going well in negotiations. And we've got a PA budget that is, I stumbled into law, I mean, you know, and now we're right on the verge of the start of the you know, the craziness of the Republican convention out in Cleveland and the Democratic convention on the week following. So, I mean, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, no, there's just a lot going on. I don't know how to explain it. I mean, couple that on top of what you're watching, what's happening across the pond over in England with the Brexit.
Yeah.
With this country just completely self-imploding and self-destructing intentionally upon themselves, you know, what they vote to leave and then, David Cameron steps down and overnight you have a completely different ideologic regime change in there.
Right.
Boris Johnson, their Donald Trump-esque figure of England, is now the leading diplomat, might be one of the most hated like men in all of Europe and probably, you know, with United States relations with the shit he said. He's now leading the country's diplomacy. Oh, man. It's happening on both fronts, you know, over there and over here.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I mean, I don't know how else would. There is so much going on, you know, but I do think that if you have to look on the positive end of that, right? I mean, if we're going to, you know, boil the world down in negatives and positives, but, you know, there's also a tremendous amount of organizing, even in the, what we, you know, see like with the Brexit over in England, the Labour Party might just have a really progressive comeback and finally kind of shed its skin of the kind of the Tony Blair legacy over there.
Yeah. You have Jeremy Corbyn, who looks like he's, you know, is facing one of the worst coup attempts ever by his own people in his own party. And it looks like he's just going to absolutely trounce his two opponents in the upcoming Labour leader elections. He's bringing in, you know, 500, he's brought in 60,000 more people. Labour is at what, record levels when it comes to all-time membership. He's done that. And you have the elites not wanting him, but the people are going to just vote for him anyway. I mean, he could be their next PM for all we know, which is a great message for people who support Labour and people who support radical left politics, you know, especially over here in the United States.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to draw the comparisons too closely, right? I mean, because, you know, we are talking about two different political systems. They have a parliamentary system. You know, we have this kind of representative republic. But I think the sentiment, right, that is launching Corbyn forward, the kind of complete frustration of the bankrupt policies of, you know, this whole kind of third way politics, you know, that we're talking about corporate Democrats over here, or we're talking about the neoliberal wing of the Labour Party over in England. You know, we're really at a point where we're seeing bits of the sea change, you know, and I don't want to get, you know, too far ahead of it. But, you know, you just look at the organizing around Black Lives Matter right now and the expansion of that movement. And they're just absolutely the absolute refusal of that movement to go away. So, you know, not only as absolutely horrific, especially the videos, man, the videos of Anton Sterling and Castillo, just watching those things, he's like, you got this, here we go again. And
one of the things that really I've liked a lot, and I noticed the responses of those videos can bring out the worst in people, but actually the discipline within this movement has brought forward, the discipline of the movement is there, but it seems like it could be filtering down to those in the community who would otherwise might act out or start a riot over this. Seeing those videos, those should have started riots, in my opinion, like seeing those videos.
I would say at least, I don't know if they should have started riots, but I said, you know, given what they did, I mean, it's astounding that they didn't. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, like that's my. I don't obviously think that people should have started riots over that, but like in the past, that's what would have happened easily. I mean,
I think we're seeing now. I mean, just for example, we're seeing, you know, just the kind of the evolution of tactics too as well. I mean, the fact that you've got bridges being shut down, highways being shut down. I mean, that whole development, where it's not just it's the outpouring of absolute rage, right, about another black man being killed, unarmed black man being killed at the hands of the police. The rage of that should just kind of like be front and center. And it was. But There's that also range. The determination of, you know, we are not going quietly into the night. You know, I mean, this is, you know, this is something else to behold. And frankly, you know, in the wake of the kind of going to your point about the kind of online, you know, what happens online and social media after these things, some of what, you know, I think that some of the folks from the Bernie Sanders campaign need to learn a lesson from Black Lives Matter. And that lesson is that you just don't fold up your hands, pout, and go away, right? That you just double down on your organizing, right? And that I'm not saying that therefore everyone should go vote for Hillary. That's not my point here. My point is that continue to build that movement, because you've got Black Lives Matter movement is something to behold, and I think is actually going to get us closer to some significant change. And what is the potential of what was going on with the Sanders campaign, potential of that, you know, that kind of Occupy-esque feel of a lot of that movement, if they keep kind of battening down, you're going to have a couple really powerful movements building in this country.
And one of the things that's like, there wasn't really like that feeling when Wisconsin happened, before Wisconsin happened, of like a populist. But like Wisconsin opened up that thing and opened up, in my opinion, opened all of this up. Like, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people fighting back in Wisconsin. But it feels worse. Like, you know, I was involved with the Occupy movement in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Went up to New York a couple times. This now today feels a lot different than 2011.
How so? But,
I mean, it feels like, I feel like the rage and frustration is there among people. But like the movement's not there, but it seems like there's just all these things that are happening that it feels like it's going to boil over soon. Like it feels you don't know where it's heading.
No, and I think, you know, go ahead.
With the mass shootings that have happened, you know, with the Sanders campaign, with the advances with the Fight for 15, you have all these things going on, and the Fight for 15, the low-wage workers, they are also part of the Black Lives Matter community. So you have that crossing of the two movements right there, and it feels like the organizing, it feels like something's going to happen, but you can't tell what.
No, exactly. No, I'm glad you brought up the Fight for 15 stuff, because that's something I completely left out there. Is you've got like the rebirth of a kind of more militant labor movement out there too, as well. I mean, this is really an exciting time, right? If we pull away from, you know, like, you know, especially from the Sanders campaign people, like the people that were organizing the grassroots folk, they could pull away for a little bit and look at the kind of amazing organizing that is going on right now. I mean, there is a lot of reason to hope if people, you know, keep their nose to the grindstone. And I have to say is that the thing about this being a presidential election year is that, you know, we've kind of got these targets out there, right, which I think are helping kind of focus some of the movement in some ways. I mean, I think Black Lives Matter was focused already. But from these other movements, now we're basically saying, okay, not only do we have, is there this political campaign, but we have an opportunity to kind of to build a movement that can push agendas in a much more progressive like direction, regardless if we're talking about within the Democratic Party or outside the Democratic Party. There's, you know, I expect there to be kind of pretty significant protest outside both the Republican and the Democratic National Convention.
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be that's going to be really interesting to see, especially at the Democratic National Convention. I was getting emails that Kashwana Savant is coming in from Seattle to talk to a bunch of the Bernie protesters at FDR Park across from the Wells Fargo Center. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens and what's the there's already actions going on in the city. You know, the Clean Energy Revolution folks are doing some guerrilla art and doing some guerrilla actions right now. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. You know, I wish I could be out there in Cleveland. Unfortunately, they can't get out there to Cleveland.
Nigel Farage is going to be out there in Cleveland. Yeah, the person who led Brexit, who led the Brexit movement.
it just doesn't get better than this. I mean, if it wasn't so serious, you know, I was like, really, really. Right, you're gonna bring that dude over here who just, you know, just tanked the British pound. Like, I mean, so whatever. I mean, this is great. Bring him in, man. Bring him in. I mean, everyone else is turning Trump down. I guess he's got to go, like, go internationally here. This is going to be his foreign policy.
Like, imagine that. Like, this is where this country is heading if they elect Trump, where England and the United States would have sociopaths running the country.
You know, and at first it seemed like, you know, there was this discussion over and with Brexit that, you know, maybe that they weren't going to go through with it. They just needed this. And then now everyone, and, you know, my neighbor's actually, he's from England. He's Scottish, right? But he got lived in London and his sister lives in London. And he was saying, he's like, yeah, there's a bunch of people who were, you know, like the old days when they could go down to the pub and, you know, just talk to people that they knew. And that's what they voted for. But nobody had a plan. Right. They everyone was completely like deer in the headlights, including the people who were the most fierce advocates for Brexit. So it's just, I mean, I'm telling you, it's crazy.
And now one of the fiercest people, he's the diplomat. Oh, he's the foreign secretary. He's like the secretary of state. Is going to be is Boris Johnson. I mean, you might as well just bring back the George. And then happening in the same week. George Bush is seen dancing.
Did you see that? I know. I was going to bring that up. I was like, George Bush. I was like, what? I showed my wife last night. I'm like, you've got to see this. He's like, this guy, you know, I don't even know what to say. It's like, he's lost his marbles.
I saw like a day after it happened. Like I read about it and I was just like, yeah, okay. Like I briefly like looked over on like the stuff that's popping up my newsfeed, but I never watched the video. And then like I was watching the Young Turks the other night and they played the whole entire video straight through, like all like 1 minute and 30 seconds of it. And I was just like, I was floored.
I could not believe it. I don't know how Michelle Obama kept it together.
And even like, they're both like, kind of just like the look on their face is like, his wife's look. And then Michelle Obama's look, they're like, what are you doing?
Yes. Yeah. Laura Bush is kind of like, George, you are going to be in so much trouble when we get home.
And he's the only person wearing a blue suit.
I know.
He's in a bright blue suit for a funeral.
Oh, my God. It's just like everything is like, you know, the earth is moving on its axis. I don't know. It's just like there's so much stuff going on.
There's so much crazy going on.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, you know, and one, you know, I was actually, the Bush video was like, I'm thankful for that, if I have to be thankful for George Bush for one thing, because just between the, you know, the more police shootings and then seeing the police get shot, is like, that's, you know, we're talking, that's a serious, dangerous situation. Because if you're getting people, and like, look, this, whoever it is, you know, whatever, you know, I'm sure they're going to cover all sorts of things about this guy. I've already started, you know, about the shooter, about uncovered things about him. Is like, and, you know, he's clearly had some out there ideas and all this other kinds of stuff, like you always see with this, with this kind of thing. But the very fact that people's, at least one person's anger and rage is getting channeled back into like, well, the only solution to this is just to kill police officers. I mean, that is a super, super dangerous precedent. And, you know, I'm also thankful for the police chief from Dallas, because I think he, and there was that doctor that was interviewed too as well. And they talked about the, you know, the complexity of their experiences and how we need to solve this. So I was very happy to see that things didn't immediately jump into, you know, people went to their corners and say, you know, police are great, or like, you know, Black Lives Matter is perfect, and just go back and forth, you know, and have gone and kind of war like that. But really started, you know, had a brief moment of looking through, you know, through a window of the difficulty of this, of what we're facing.
And basically, you know, where he said we have to tear down these divisions between us and the community. Like, and, you know, and Dallas has been one of the more progressive police forces,
right,
departments in the country. They still have their problems. Yes, there's still people out there, but they embrace their community. They, and that's one of the things I could say about the Philadelphia Police Department over the past few years. Yes, there has been many controversial incidents between the police departments, but when people are out there protesting, the cops are usually standing with us. We're friendly. People are taking pictures with the police department, and there's friendly interactions going on between the Civil Affairs Department and the people protesting. And it seems like Dallas is way ahead of Philadelphia in that respect. And when you have a right after the shooting happened, he was talking about how, yes, this guy said he hates cops and he wants to kill cops. Yeah, but the police officer went off, the commissioner went on to say, but we also have to break down these divisions within from the police department and the community.
Right, right.
You know, and we have to take the lead on this, which is like you couldn't ask for more of a response out of that.
No, I mean, exactly. And I think from, you know, from kind of the movement perspective, right, what this opens up in my mind is the opportunity, like the way that this that was being discussed, it further opens up some space for some more significant kinds of changes, right? You know, as say Dr. Eddie Glaude, he's a professor of religion and African American studies. He was on the Majority Report yesterday, and they were talking about really some long term strategy, both at the political level, but then also really putting a face on how we should understand race and racism, right? You know, the idea that it's not simply about like the hearts and minds of each one of these individuals, right? We're talking about historical, structural, like in inequality and inequities, right? That continues to reproduce this structure of racism, right? So yes, we have to do police training. Yes, we have to do, make sure that there's investigations. Yes, prosecutors who refuse to go after and file charges against police officers need to be disbarred. You know, things like that need to happen. But there's also an opportunity to talk about race in I think at least in much more structural ways right now, that where the history is not lost. It's not simply a matter of good people and bad people in their hearts. It's about what we do as a society to kind of rectify and finally put a stop to this, just this craziness. And one of the things I was thinking about was to say, I guess the analog would be this is like, if you have, I was thinking about Moynihan, right? Moynihan was, he's notorious for coming out with this whole idea about, this culture of poverty in poor areas, right? Say that the problem of where poverty comes from is that from people learn how to be poor and they become kind of, messed up, right? Their culture becomes messed up and that's what keeps them poor, right? So, and there was a couple, even that horrible way of framing the issue that had two different kinds of options there. One would be to say, okay, we need to develop programs that are going to assist people to change that culture or to change the way they're educated so that they can get out of that situation, right? And that's really the road that this culture has gone. Like the United States, that's the road we've gone. But the other option there was like, no, okay, even if you're going to buy into that most regressive way of framing the issue as the culture of poverty, the other way of framing it is to say, well, then you just need to end poverty, right? If you actually want to begin to start healing, you need to end poverty. Just like solve the problems in schools, well, guess what you need to do? You need to fund the freaking schools, right? I mean, this is kind of one of the things that we're at the core. And I think that Black Lives Matter from the get-go has been out with this message. But the fact that some of the discussion is shifting, even from public officials, is at least shows you that there's even more of a chance of an opening right now to make some significant progress.
No, I completely agree with you.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. Well, listen, we should take a break here. I can just go on forever, because I've been kind of out of it for a while and there's so much on my mind. But we're going to take a little bit of break. And when we come back, we mentioned this a little bit right at the start of the show today. Pennsylvania now has a budget. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the Pennsylvania budget, where things seem to be standing right now, and some of the most unproductive responses to the most recent round of shootings and the police killings that are coming right from our own Pennsylvania legislature and next door over there in New Jersey. When we come back, we'll talk with Sean a little about the PA budget and, oh, God, the limited imaginations of our legislator. All right, we'll be back right after this. This is Raging Chicken Radio. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day that Woody Guthrie was born in Okemah, Oklahoma. Guthrie became one of the most prolific songwriters to ever sing the stories of the working class. His most well-known song is "This Land Is Your Land," an anthem whose lyrics claim America for the common man. During the Great Depression, Guthrie traveled from Oklahoma to California with farmers driven off their land by the ravages of the Dust Bowl. He talked with them and learned their stories and songs. He spent the rest of his life singing the songs of those downtrodden. His guitar bore the message, "This machine kills fascists." Guthrie believed in the power of music. His songs serve as a lasting impression for many musicians, from his own son Arlo Guthrie to Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, and many more. Even today, Guthrie's music asks powerful questions about how we as a nation treat workers. In his song "Deportees," Guthrie tells the story of migrant Mexican farm workers. His lyrics explain, "We died in your hills, we died in your deserts, we died in your valleys and died in your plains. We died neath your trees, we died in your buses. Both sides of the river, we died just the same." He ends the song by asking, "Is this the best way we can grow our big orchards? Is this the best way we can grow our good fruit?" Like so many of Guthrie's songs, these questions remain unanswered.
You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. Oh, they will call you the deportees.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. Each week, we take a look at the good, the bad, and the ugly of Harrisburg, PA, with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen. Sean, one of the things I came back to after vacation was Governor Wolf was basically saying, "Hey, okay, you guys passed the spending plan. You didn't say how you're going to pay for it, so I'm not going to sign it, but I'll let it come into law." I mean, what's going on with this?
Yes. So I was actually pretty surprised to see the governor do that the other night. I actually liked that he did that. Say, you passed it, you own it, you got to find a spending plan for it. Mm-hmm. And kind of forced the hand of Republicans to come up with some money. They did that. They came up with revenue.
I was surprised. I mean, I got to say, I did not expect them to turn around. And we should say, right, there are Democrats on board with this too as well, right? This is not strictly yes. Republicans.
No, it was bipartisan. I'm sort of not surprised just mm-hmm. from seeing some of the folks I see passing in and out of work. Everyone's still battle weary from last year. Even some of our friends on Facebook are posting, like, "Thank God the budget's over with." I think everyone on both sides of the issue wanted to get the budget done.
Is it because they were battle wearied, or is it just because it's an election year, and so people are just more focused on that and just want it out of the way?
I think it's probably because it's an election year. The budget did increase some things. I mean, it's still an austere budget, but there was some money thrown around, and I mean, I think that they wanted to get that out there pretty quickly. The conservatives, your diehards, they're extremely upset with the budget. Wagner was one of only three senators to vote against it. Metcalf and others didn't vote for the budget or the revenue plan. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like that they were left out. But the revenue plan is regressive taxation.
Like what? Walk us through a little bit about how this kind of Republican Democratic budget decided to pay for itself. How these folks paid for it.
What I think expanded revenues from liquor modernization, which might ultimately begin that road of privatization, a tobacco bill increase, or smokeless tobacco is now included, chew and stuff like that are now increased with taxes, pouch tobacco received more tax. So regressive taxation right there, $1 per pack of cigarettes is now up there. And then a $200 million transfer from them.
Yeah, no, I also thought it was interesting that they're planning on now on taxing digital downloads too as well. So that's a brand new source of revenue from, so if you're downloading music, you're downloading books and that kind of stuff, there's going to be a tax that's going on those.
Yeah, but I mean, it's, there was no big broad-based tax increase with personal natural gas industry. And once again, the gas industry, an actual credible source of funding that supports the gas companies that are going to pay for it, you know, not the citizens, are now, again, another year without a budget or without a tax. And what's that, 6-7 years now, basically, without severance tax?
Absolutely. And this is exactly what, you know, you kind of led with. This is the why it's regressive. And this is why, you know, even bringing up some of the digital downloads too, as well, is that you're adding in another source of revenue. But once again, it's going to hit people with the least amount of money the most, right? Because it's a higher percentage of their income. And you know, again, this is what you would expect from a Republican dominated legislature, right? And with, you know, lots of, kind of very happy conservative Democrats who are kind of happy to jump on board with this kind of stuff.
And the ethical thing of ethical issues of online gaming. I'm against casinos and stuff like that ideologically because, and the taxes, the money, it's just it's a tax on the poor people. And now we have another tax on the poor people with online gaming. And you're preying people who have gambling addiction problems as the main source of income. That's an that's also an ethical moral issue. But we don't have a problem trying to look for $100 million. Which is pocket change to fund a budget. So,
yeah, it's crazy. And you started to say this, and I'm sorry, I kind of broke in, but you were also saying that, you know, and I think this is, you know, I'm just kind of looking through some of the budget stuff here too, as well, is that $200 million is coming from borrowing from the surplus of a state medical malpractice insurance fund. And that has to be repaid back over a 5-year period. And that's one of the things that Wolf was really, really resistance to. He did not want any kind of these one-time cash infusion gimmicks or kind of accounting gimmicks that would make it look like it was a balanced budget, but not really. But it seems like he lost that battle too as well. I mean, it doesn't mean that everything is that way. I mean, in some ways, I think we could argue that there's less of that this time from compared to Corbett budgets. But at the very least, most of this is either regressive taxation or it is, you know, stuff that's going to have to be paid back or is just going to have to be fought over again next year. So, you know, I don't see the fights over the budget going away anytime soon, nor do I see this as really solving any of the significant problems facing the state.
No. They're away until September. So,
yeah, that's true.
The insanity in Harrisburg is to wind down a little bit.
Yeah, and at least, you know, the one things we can count on is that if we have to, you know, I was thinking about what Madeline Dean said. She wanted to focus on some of the positive stuff. You know, she's been very big on she's a Democrat. She's been very big on education stuff. And if you had to look at the positive end of the budget, K-12 funding is back up to 2010-2011 levels. Right. And, you know, if you're an outsider walking into this process for the first time and you look at that and you're like, that's a victory, right? But given the cuts in education, that actually is going to have a positive impact. It is nowhere near where things need to be. But if you start to step up that next level, you go into higher education, this budget only restores about a quarter of the funding that was cut during Tom Corbett's first year. So there's still an uphill climb there. Pennsylvania is still, you know, 49th. It ranks 49th in state investment in higher education. And this is really not going to help move us up any higher than 49th. And, you know, right now, as I mentioned earlier, that the faculty union there, ABSCUF, over 5,000 faculty members and coaches, they're still without contracts, and that is heating up. It's going into day 379 without a contract. And, you know, we're going to see the impacts of this certainly for years to come. Just because we got an election coming up doesn't mean that the fights on the local level and around the state aren't going to continue.
Yep. And one of the things, the state finally did get a some sort of funding formula, public education K-12.
That's a good point. That's an important point.
So I think,
yeah, because that is a significant win. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I think one without qualification a win.
Yeah, that's something the state needed. We were only one of two states in the country without a funding formula for so many years, and it looks like finally we got a funding formula that's here to stay for a bit. So, you know, now money gets shifted into poorer schools, which is a win. than something we got.
Right. Well, so, okay. So the legislators, they're all getting ready to pack their bags and go home for the summer, enjoy their pools and, campaign, but we'll see what they're going to be doing out there. It's probably going to be spouting some more ideological nonsense if you're a GOP member. But it seems like, before they left, right, before they get out of here, they seem to have time to, join the national debate around Black Lives Matter and these police shootings in the most non-productive way possible.
Yes. So a Democrat from Altoona, Pennsylvania, Altoona, Johnstown area out in western PA, a rural Pennsylvania Democrat, part of that God's Guns and Labor Caucus of the Democratic Party, decided to introduce a Blue Lives Matter bill. This is a national campaign. We've seen these bills pop up in states around the country. Louisiana was, ironically, the first state to pass this bill back in May. Pennsylvania and New Jersey are two states that just recently, Wisconsin joined recently, and Kentucky, and a bunch of others. And there's a few other states that I think are listed up to 9 right now, or 10 have pending Blue Lives Matter legislation. And what this bill would do would make it a hate crime for physical crimes committed against police officers or law or corrections officers. It would be a hate crime to do that. And it would bring stricter punishments to people who might get involved with protests or where physical altercations are usually involved, like assaulting a police officer. And that could become a hate crime in many of these states. And my opinion, it's a way to silence protesters. And it's racially motivated, too.
Absolutely.
I think it's a racist piece of legislation. And you're not, and no one in the media is telling you.
No, and I tell you, being against this bill has nothing to do with being against or being for assaults on police officers. That is not the point, right? The point is that all this is basically trying to kind of further insulate police and to put more criminal penalties on kind of other folks, right? To embolden the police, basically, to continue things as they are, right? Frankly, this is not an equal scenario, like equal situation, right? It's not like Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, like Rudy Giuliani was shooting off over the course this week. This is not it. And, I find it insulting, frankly, that, they want to make this as a hate crime. Right. And why do I find it insulting? Well, OK, so it adds to the categories, right? By our Constitution, right? You have federally protected categories that are against discrimination. Right. Right now, they are race, color, religion, and national origin. Right. This would add it to that. The one thing that's missing from that, right, they're proposing this bill at the same time that it is still legal to discriminate against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people in the state.
Yeah, so Frank Burns, and it just shows you how our Democratic Party still is in this state. The things we've been witnessing over the past few months, and it's also showing that this is bipartisan support. I think Massachusetts has a bill like this sitting in its legislature, and Democrats are supporting it. Out in Michigan, Democrats are supporting it. Rural Democrats who might be supporting this bill, and it's not going to further anymore. It's going to make these issues worse. And when I was writing about this yesterday, these are people who are supporting this stuff, and they will actually never have to experience the consequences of communities, or they're living in a white rural America. While, some of us are living in cities or suburbs of major cities, in a major city in the state, and we're the ones who are going to, citizens in Harrisburg and other cities are going to be the ones that deal with these consequences. I know exactly why he's doing this. He's a Democrat in a Republican part of the state. He's a dying breed within the local Democratic Party, and he's pandering to the rural whites. Say, hey, you should vote for me because I support cops, because I support Blue Lives Matter.
Yeah, exactly. And really what that says, right? And that's the dog whistle politic of it. Really, it says, I'm against black people, too. I mean, that's really what the dog whistle message is of this kind of legislation.
It's such a great response because first they ignore you, and then they do that, and then they fight you, and then you win.
Yeah, there you go.
Back. Yeah, this is them fighting back, and this is the best ideas that they can come up with. Like, what sane, rational governor of a state would sign this bill in the law? Chris Christie would,
Yeah, Chris Christie. Yeah, he would. Yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah, we'll say. You know, I know everybody's waiting on pins and needles right now too to see whether Christie's going to get the VP nod for Trump, or if it's going to be Pence, or if Trump is going to. You know, who the hell knows? Maybe he'll he'll have our good friend Nigel see if he can join the ticket. Last minute naturalization process and our ceremony. Anyways, all right, we're coming up to a break, and in the last segment today, we're just going to talk beer, folks. You know, it's been a crazy, exactly. It's been a crazy political week, and just so much going on. So we're going to end this one on a fun note. So we'll be back right after this. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This is Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. We'll be right back.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. I'm sitting here with Sean Kitchen today, and it's been a whirlwind day of politics, and so now we shift to beer. So, Sean, I'll tell you, I was, you know, everyone should know, Sean is really, really responsible for, you know, my entry into the craft beer world. Look, I always liked beer. I was always a big kind of stout fan. I love to check things out, but just kind of Sean's passion for it has kind of rubbed off a bit. So now routinely when I go someplace, one of the things I'm always looking for is you know, are there any kind of really local breweries to kind of go and visit, you know, stuff that doesn't have cans, doesn't have bottles out, it's not doing it, you know, maybe it'll ship some kegs out, but they're not production facilities. Most of beer is sold out of the brewery itself. So when I was up in the Adirondacks, I was able to go to a couple great places, and I want to give a shout out to the Fulton Chain Craft Brewery up there in Old Forge, New York. I got a chance to talk to one of the owners and talk a little about his process and his beer and so on. And a shout out to the folks at Woodland Hop Farm and Fermentation in Marcy, New York. That one's only about 6 months old. So just start with Fulton Chain. Is like, you know, to give it, this is right in the heart of Old Forge, New York. And if people have never been up that way, Old Forge is kind of right before you start getting into, it's right about Fulton Chain of Lakes, right? You got First Lake, Second Lake, Third Lake, up to 10th Lake. Before about a couple hours outside of Lake Placid, south of Lake Placid, about an hour north of Utica, New York, on Route 12. And it's kind of one of the snowmobilers' capitals of the country, right? They have incredible snowmobile trails and all this great skiing up there. And in the summertime, just great places to go swimming and hiking and everything like that. But so anyway, so last year when I was up there visiting my folks, the Fulton Chain Craft Brewery was just opening up, and we just did not have time to get over there given other things that we had to do and kind of weather and travel, blah, blah, blah. But this year, so just about their 1 year anniversary, was able to go there, and my wife and I did a sample of all their beers, and it was a fun place. And I would almost think about this as kind of like, it's like a concept brewery, if that makes sense. And the reason I say that, when I was talking to one of the owners, he was saying that, you know, he and his friends have been coming up the Adirondacks their whole lives. And one of the things what they, you know, they come into the Adirondacks, they wanted to capture that spirit of the Adirondack in their beers. And so even some of their more experimental stuff, you can see that's what they're going after. So it's kind of really interesting. And I want to plug three in particular. One, that this one was surprising to me. There's one, it's called Bear Road. It's a blueberry coffee stout. And I'll be honest with you, I did not expect to like this. I'm like, blueberry coffee, it's it was great. It was fantastic. It's like, they use locally roasted coffee beans. Was super. But the one that was really surprising was this one. It was a Saison, and it was a cucumber lime Saison. Like, once again, I'm like, there's no way. And this guy I was talking to, he was saying that the inspiration for that beer came from cranberry lime Gatorade, which one of the other owners apparently claims is the most refreshing form of Gatorade. And so I was like expecting this really, I don't know, weird saccharine sweet. It was delicious. It was refreshing. And he called it summer in a glass. So that was definitely cool. And then the last one I'll kind of talk about there is just there's this one called Fireside. And he said, like, look, the whole idea was to try to, you know, you drive in, you get into your campsite, and the first thing you smell is the campfire. And so, yeah, this is my Fireside. It's an American amber ale, and it is definitely smoky. It's like on the order of a Rauch beer, but it's an American amber ale. You got to like the smoke for this one. I'll warn you ahead of time, but it's worth it, at least for the novelty of it. But it was really good. So kudos to those folks up there in Fulton Chain. We'll be sending you a link up there because, you know, I told them about the podcast and I told them that we talk about the beers and stuff. So definitely a definitely important place to visit. If you're up in the Adirondack area, swing by Old Forge and the Fulton Chain craft brewery there. The big surprise for me, though, was the Woodland Hop Farm and Fermentation. It's a farm brewery. It's only 6 years old. It's literally 6 months old, and it's literally like a bike ride away from my folks' house, like at the top of this big hill. And I think it used to be an unfinished furniture factory called Marty's Jungle. I forgot to ask them there if that's what it was. But holy cow, the beer was outstanding. They specialize in, you know, kind of farmhouse brews. They are just getting their own hops going. They have two vines growing right now, but the plan is to expand that quite significant. They use as much locally grown stuff as possible to try to keep it all New York State, if not Oneida County, which is that immediate region. And I'm telling you, everything I had from them was outstanding. A great range of beers. With a real focus on kind of casks, like cask fills and stuff. I guess the way that they put it is, like, you know, they focus on kind of farm beers and saisons, a lot of it. They have some really great stouts, but they're really doing lots of stuff in barrel aging and cask pours. And while I was there, I had just some outstanding stuff. They have like a new cask every Tuesday that they put on tap. You have a frequent card, and the one that I had when I sampled when I was there was called a Black Hole in My Mind. It's a chocolate brown ale, it's aged on black peppercorns, and it was just like, it was to die for. But the one I came out of there most thrilled at, I wanted to get something that was 100% New York State, and they had this farmhouse ale called Down and Dandy. It's like a really light, kind of light, very floral and grassy. Has Cascade hops in it, and they have dandelions, right, and farmhouse yeast. And didn't know what to expect, but it was fantastic. Go ahead.
I know. I was just letting it go on. I mean,
no, I know. I'm just reliving it right now. You can tell.
Yeah. But no, like, that one sounds really good. Like, out of all the ones you were talking about.
I wish, you know, I sat there. We didn't. I was going to try to bring. They had both 32-ounce and 32-ounce and 64-ounce growlers there, and I was going to try to bring you back one of those ones. I thought you would have loved that.
Yeah,
it was so delicious. I mean, they had these other ones too. I got this. They had, you know, this one they tapped specifically for the fourth. It was called America, right? And it was like a session IPA. It was hot with cashmere and Pacific and stuff. And that was really solid and good. It was like, came to be like, 4% ABV. So it was like, you know, really low alcohol. And that was delicious. But the Down and Dandy, holy moly. The one thing that I really liked, they did not do, growler pours of this. But I did taste it, was this one, Carl the Great. It's a Kolsch. It's one of the best Kolsches I've had by an American brewery, hands down. So, I mean, that was another nice surprise. So yeah, nice. A bunch of stuff.
While you were away, I had some good beer stories of my own. You know, I helped out with the canning process at Pizza Boy that day.
And posted some videos of the process.
It was actually really cool. So, like, they brought in a mobile canning unit. The thing fit inside a small box truck. It was maybe like 5 feet wide. Then the whole process was like the whole machinery was 20 feet long. So it wasn't too big, or like 15 feet long, 5 by 15. If we were in cramped quarters, but we were canning and stickering and filling up cases and building pallets all day. And that was really cool. Bourbon Barrel Sunnyside Up flew out of the store within 6 hours. The regular Sunnyside, get this, the regular Sunnyside and the Citra Pills, which we canned, the Citra Pills came out phenomenal. All gone within a week.
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of people were buying up for the 4th of July weekend. And then we're also in the process of getting some of our beers back on. So we're putting on a ghost pepper, ancho chili, and chipotle peppered Sunnyside Up firkin.
My God.
Which that's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting to see the reactions of people on that. And,
yeah, I bet. I wish I could be there for it. Yeah. I wish I could be there for it.
And then we're putting our IPAs coming back, the Marin River. And then we are getting a new pale ale on. So it's going to be pretty cool.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. I was fascinated, you know, from some of the short videos that you posted. I was just fascinated seeing that. So it's basically, you know, this is the kind of setup. You come in, you can, and then they pack it all up and put it back on the truck and take off, right?
Yeah, like this canning unit. And then we keep the beer, you know, with us. But, yeah, right, that's pretty much what it was. When we got there at 8:30 in the morning, where the guy's like, how many, like he said, we could probably do about 60 barrels of cans a day. Mm-hmm. And that's what pretty much we did, like 66. It was a company record for them. Basically, we're halfway through canning, and it was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're like, just like, you know what, screw it. Let's get it all done. The boss said, let's get it. Let's do it all. It went really smooth after we worked out the kinks in the morning. It went really smooth after that. Probably the hardest part was getting the stickers on everything, because it's like you got these cases building up right behind you. It moves really fast. But it was a pretty fun process. Just 10 hours of canning and stacking pallets and putting stickers on cans of beer.
That's got to be so. I think it's just fascinating, especially that, you know, it's kind of mobile setup. Come in and set it out. And this was the first like mass canning you guys did, right?
Yeah. And what's really cool is like we all came in and we volunteered on our spare time. People who did come in outside of the brewer, the people with the canning, you know, the people working, the two brewers in the back and the owner Al. But we had about 5 or 6 volunteers come in that made the process go a lot quicker and a lot easier. So. It was actually pretty fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think that's really cool. This is one of the things about, you know, the whole craft beer industry is that, you know, people are willing to help build these companies, right? You come in, you volunteer your time. And obviously you don't want to, you know, build a business out of volunteer time. You know, that's not the point. But the fact that, you know, people care about a lot about the beer, a lot about the process, can be involved in it and all this stuff. And, you know, to be there for that, you know, that first ever canning, that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, it was actually really fun. And then tomorrow we have a bottle release, Intangible Ales, which is a project of the head brewers. They're going to be releasing, a dry hop sour with apricot, Himalayan sea salt, and it's going to be soured with Brettanomyces. So it's going to be a wild farmhouse sour, apricot and sea salt.
How long has this one been sitting, you know?
I think it's been sitting in the bottles for at least a year now.
Nice.
Over a year. So
nice. So this is good. Probably another one that is not going to last on the shelves too long.
Yeah. It'll probably last a week or so.
A week or so, man. And well, I'm telling you, I hope I can get out there and grab some. Right. So, so cool. Well, listen, Sean, man, it's going to be back in a rhythm. Everyone knows, I know this is a little strange. I forgot to mention this at the top, but this is a Thursday. If you remember 2 weeks ago, we talked a little bit about shifting up some programming. So that we're going to go to Thursday release instead of a Tuesday release. Sean's schedule has switched up, and it actually works very good on my end too as well. So that we're going to be out the coop is going to be coming out to you on Thursdays. We will also get back to sessions of the sit down through our interview show. We got some interesting possibilities in the works for coverage of the Democratic National Convention in particular. I've been talking to some independent journalists and who are going to be covering it, and some activists who are going to be organizing out there. So we hope to get some of them on for next week's show and the week after. We're also going to try, just so you guys know, going to try to do some live streaming, Facebook live videos. Maybe we'll experiment with Periscope a little bit, but we've had good success with our Facebook live stuff. If we get decent internet connection, we'll stick with that. Just from down there in the Democratic National Convention, and should remind everyone on July 24th, which is the day before the Democratic National Convention, there is the March for a Clean Energy Revolution, which will be taking place in Philadelphia right outside the convention center. And we'll be there for that too as well. So we're going to try to do some kind of on the ground, on location, streaming from there, and then supplement some of that with some interviews and some discussion with activists down there. So tune in. We'll try to keep you up to date on that. So, Sean, you got any plans come down for the convention?
I'm thinking about it. You know, I'm off Wednesday and Thursday, so I just have to see what lines up with. See if anything's going to be happening down there during those days. But I would like to head down at least. Yeah,
it'd be great. Maybe. No, so because who knows? Maybe we'll do a little kind of if you do come down on Wednesday. So I think I'm gonna be there Tuesday, Wednesday, maybe Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'll look at again what's going on, but then maybe we do some live stuff from down there too as well.
Sounds great.
All right, man. Well, have an awesome day, and I'm glad to be back in the swing of things. And we'll talk to you next week.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor, founder of Raging Chicken Press. This has been Out the Coop Radio's Out the Coop Podcast. We'll talk to you next week. We're out of here. See ya!